welcome to the Explorers Podcast with Ken Bowen. Here, Ken connects with friends and peers to discuss issues in the world and practices to improve one's biblical perspective.
Welcome to the Explorers Podcast. I'm Ken Bowen, and I'm with my special guest, K.J. Johnson. K.J. heads up the C.S. Lewis Institute in the Chicago area, and I'm delighted to have you with me. And we're just connecting together and remembering some former times we had when I was up there in the Chicago area, and it was a rich experience we shared.
Good to be with you, Ken.
We were just talking about the whole idea of spiritual warfare and about the idea of the nature of forgiveness as a spiritual resource or kind of a weapon that defeats the power of the onslaught. And so that to think of forgiveness, to think of generosity, to think of kindness as weapons is an interesting notion, isn't it? It's not so much of the, we were just discussing, if we're not careful, we can get too offensive in the nature of our ideology and our descriptions of warfare and let the metaphor become the master. It's a good servant, but a poor master when you make a metaphor walk on all fours.
Yeah, I agree. When I teach on warfare and just discipleship in general, I like to point out that it's very easy to get enamored with, especially in today's polarized situation and culture we live in. We can get very offensive and offensive in our approach. And I like to remind folks that the weapons and the tools we have aren't the world's.
They are a different set of tools altogether, and the weapon of grace. It's almost can be seen. It's so countercultural. Even friendship. I've been thinking about this because on my Sunday morning class here in Atlanta, I'm teaching, reteaching The Four Loves by C.S. Lewis, and I hadn't taught that since 1990. It's a great book to revisit, but the idea of how it's so countercultural and it becomes a realization that each of these human loves has the seeds of its own unique forms of hatred. And here he's speaking about this dynamic of the distorted goods of friendship and so forth, and of eros and of storge. Of all these things that can be have their strengths, but also have a unique seed of its own hatred, and so it can happen with all these things as well.
Yeah, well, I mean, I can't think of any other worldview that really calls you to love your enemy. Not just love your neighbor, but love your enemy, and that is a response to persecution, hatred, division.
Yes. So forgiveness is a grace. Forgiveness is a weapon. And the thing that I was thinking about with C.S. Lewis is friendship, as I now see it, is so countercultural. It is one of the most countercultural things we can do in this time and age where people are becoming more isolated, more lonely, to have the idea of covenant relationships with other people for the commitment of another's good is a pretty powerful vision of what that's like. And he just so beautifully developed that chapter. But in his argument, and he's quite right, each of the human loves contains the seeds of its own unique form of hatred. Only when the human loves are brought into the charity of God, the caritas, the agape of God, do they become what they were intended to be all along. But friendship is a powerful weapon.
Yeah. Of course, everybody loves forgiveness until they have something to forgive. Isn't that what Lewis said?
That's a great, I was just sharing with my friend, you don't want what you deserve.
No, none of us gets what we deserve. Well, that's interesting because I'm teaching, to tie it into this, I'm teaching a class on spiritual warfare and we're using Screwtape Letters as the guide. And I hearkened into one section, that passage in The Great Divorce where, you've got that guy who's just clinging to his rights. All I want is my rights. And you have this person from his earthly life appealing to him who had been a murderer. And he goes, I can't believe you're in heaven and I'm not. And all I want, he goes, I don't want no bleeding charity. And guy goes, yes, do ask for bleeding charity.
Take the bleeding charity. That's your only hope. And so his sin of pride disguised an evil that's a disguise that appears as a good. It's the self-righteous are profound in this way of justifying all those things. Yeah, I don't want any of your mercy. No, do take the mercy.
Yeah.
Again, justice is getting what you deserve, and nobody really wants that. If they stop and think about it, mercy is not getting what you deserve, and grace is getting better than you deserve. Ask for mercy and grace at the end of the day.
Yeah, these are concepts, I think, that are thrown around a little too casually these days, aren't they? I mean, justice has been sort of co-opted in a lot of different directions. I don't think we really understand mercy. Mercy is divorced from justice and many times even from true love and forgiveness.
I think that's correct. And there becomes a graceless justice orientation where you take a self-righteous stance and then vilify anyone who doesn't embrace a particular narrative. And this also leads to the danger of treating the oppressed versus the oppressor, and then looking as if the oppressed can do no wrong. There's a kind of a graceless thing, an unforgiving quality where you can't forgive others because of the self-righteous system that's been curated.
Well, that is, I'd be interested in your thoughts on this, Ken, because I feel that has played in to popular online culture. I don't know the right phrase for it, whether it's social media or news media, but in today's world of cancel culture.
Yes.
Now, there are some people who do some really dastardly things that ought to be, you know, ousted from a job or whatever. I'm not trying to diminish, you know, I mean, we could all think of the Harvey Weinsteins of the world and things like that.
Yes.
But there are other sort of transgressions or things that happen, even whether they're true or not. Sometimes it's just accusations. And this cancel culture, there are people who are just, they're run out of town and tarred and feathered, you know, proverbially. And there seems to be no real room for forgiveness. Or when there is a posturing for forgiveness, it seems more to be performative than anything else. It's like, I've just got to say these words and I've got to look sorry on camera and then we can move on. And there doesn't seem to be any real repentance.
No, there's the feigning of contrition. And at the end of the day, it's become a graceless, merciless system of oppressive self-righteousness that begins to prevail. And it feeds that arrogance and creates a posture of goodness and justice, but actually it's a seedbed of fomenting dissent and one-sidedness and a lack of grace and of forgiveness and of the human nature, that the realization that I too am culpable. I'm the one. What's wrong with the world? Remember the whole deal there with D.K. Chesterton, and he's, sir, I am, that whole idea.
That what's wrong with the world? I am.
Yeah. I'm the one that's wrong with the world.
Yeah.
But then to vilify the outsider is then to gain a sort of a notion of self-righteousness, and it's kind of a currency of
well, there seems to be also an erosion as well, because, you know, maybe I get upset with you and I cancel you, and then it's only a matter of time before I do something that transgresses the groupthink, and then now I'm gone. It seems to be this rolling thing, and you can't really stay ahead of it. Sooner or later, they come for you.
It'll bite you. It's a graceless system will get you in the end. And at the end, there'll be another one who then you offended their system. So who says, and it's then whose system? It's not pretty to watch though. But the arrogance is a feigned concern, but really a self-righteous, urge.
Yeah. I mean, you and I both know some people who have experienced this, and given some of the circles we run in, which is, you know, very sad to see. And there's a performative nature on some of the repentance and forgiveness, but there's also, I think, a performative aspect to the other side where there's some real, I mean, we've heard the term virtue signaling. I think it goes deeper than just that. I mean, I think some people are more than just trying to, you know, artificially signal some sort of virtue, but I feel like some people have found an identity in that because they can almost use that as a platform to launch themselves. And I don't know that it's necessarily insidiously or calculated, but it's just, they fall into this. They feel, like you said before, self-righteous.
Yes.
And I almost feel like there's, I don't know, I don't like to use the word victim, but there are two, you know, offended parties in this, people who are,
yeah. There's this victimhood mindset that then becomes an identity. And so then you become identified with an oppressed context, and therefore you then take moral virtue out of your victimhood, and so it goes. But then that thing will live to bite you as well, because it's not a positive thing. It's a parasite on what should be.
Yeah.
So yeah, there's a kind of a loss of grace. And the loss of the gospel, the loss of the need for repentance, not just others, but my own, starting with myself. And that, I think it's thin, but that's the dynamic. Repentance and grace is the dynamics of discipleship. And you and I were just talking before about your interest in that area, and we are kind of collaborating a little bit on this whole idea of conform to his image and pursuing the fourth soil and in a time like this and reaching a generation of people for whom we're just talking about how the three needs of our time are beauty and narrative and authenticity, and those three things really using the gospel in winsome ways to enhance and inflame people's imagination so that they want more than that they want right now. A lot of discipleship has to do with hungering and thirsting, doesn't it?
Yeah. That's, you used a word there, winsome, that I'm curious to hear your thoughts on this too.
Yeah.
There seems to be a backlash against the idea or the art of winsomeness these days.
Yes, there is. Yeah.
I've heard the term the winsome wars, you know?
There's been
a bit of a backlash on that. And that's another thing that concerns me when we start to speak of like this offensive nature of things. Not that, and I'll just say up front, I'm not saying that we need to be soft and we got to pull our punches or sell a soft gospel or water down the message. I don't think those two are necessarily the same. They can be, some can confuse those, but.
Yes. But when he speaks about letting your speech be seasoned for the outsider, season it with grace, and do it with gentleness and consideration. When we speak to people, then you speak in the sense of humility and recognizing that these are people, not projects. And the realization that we do wish to become gracious and attractive, whether you don't want to use the word winsome, any good word can be distorted.
Sure.
But I think that we want to be attractive. We want to be compelling. We want to be convincing and by their love that they're going to be known. So that's, to me, is an attractive factor.
Well, not to sit here and flatter you on your very own podcast, but I feel like you've been a good example of that. I don't think I've ever heard a cross word come out of your mouth, but I don't know any many people that are as effective in communicating the gospel as you can. So, I mean, anytime I start to maybe waver or wonder about things like that, I just take a look at you and, you know, our mutual friend Stuart and others feel like are incredibly gracious and winsome and attractive is a good word. I like
that. Yeah, I'm drawn to such
people.
I'm glad
you use that.
Yeah. So if we define our terms and just understand, why should the devil have all the best words? So even though people want to distort that, there are some things that really are needful in our time, and to be compelling, to be attractive, to be agents of grace, and season your speech with salt, as we said, so that you speak with grace and mercy and kindness and humility rather than an arrogant and offensive and overwhelming posture.
Well, and I want to be charitable. I don't know that folks want to be offensive in posture, but I wonder, you use the word compelling, and that's another one of my favorite terms, because I feel like what we need are more compelling arguments. And I wonder if those critics of winsomeness feel that the arguments they're hearing aren't compelling enough. And in some cases, maybe they're right, but that doesn't mean the answer to it is to remove the season and the grace. And I mean, I think there is time for a hard, direct word.
Of course,
Jesus was not afraid with the rich young ruler. You know, he gave him a pretty direct word,
you know,
sell all your things and follow me. That would have been a tough pill to swallow.
That's right.
But I want to be charitable. Like, what drives them to see maybe a deficiency in the way the gospel has been communicated in some ways? And maybe they feel it's not compelling.
Yes. So there's this combination of both truth and love, and to speak the truth, but to do it in love, so that some people can be very rigorous in their thought process, but not be very gracious in their practice. So there seems to me a fundamental disconnection between belief and behavior, between attitude and action, between claims and credentials, between words and works.
Yeah, that's tough. I'm going to have to chew on that one. You said a mouthful right there.
I just did. Yeah,
I threw a lot in there. I should know better when I'm hanging out with Ken Boa that I got to keep up. I don't think I can add to that. That is really well said. And I hope kind of circling into the offensive part again, I would hope that we can find a way to bridge this gap, because I am concerned about, you know, I know there's a political divide in this country, but what I'm more concerned about is the divide happening within the walls of the church, the proverbial walls. And this is just one more of those fractures or fissures that seems to be rising up, where we're just starting to draw lines and creating these, you know, it's like with that cancel culture thing, our tribes get smaller and smaller as we continue to excommunicate people. And
we shoot our wounded. Yeah. So how by shooting our wounded, by treating our own with incivility and rather than grace, it means, again, they don't grasp the depth to which they have already themselves been forgiven. When a person cannot forgive, and again, God only never invites us to forgive more than we have been forgiven. And the contrast is vast. So much more we have been forgiven than we're invited to forgive. But then there's this sort of graceless, as we said before, mindset. And it's thin as well. And it doesn't, it almost has a suspicion of anything that could be construed as good intentions or a holy sense of not a zero-sum game, but a process in which everyone is mutually edified and supported. I was just talking with a friend about this idea of networking, and we were talking about the nature of nature, the nature of created order. And the more we look at it, everything is connected together. They're reticulated networks that are organic in their nature, and the total is always greater than the sum of the parts. And when we realize that, that's the best sense of networking. Now, networking has come to be a negative term because it often is associated with using people for our ends. But I see no reason why we can't redeem that word as well and have a proper networking of other-centered goods.
Oh, I agree. I think you said it. My rule of thumb for myself in networking and just in relationships is always to treat somebody as an end in themselves. I never want to use them as a means to an end. And so if I'm not at some level, you know, you can't be deep friends with everybody. It's just, you just run out of time. Yeah. You know, I mean, Dad Lewis had said something about, you know, I wonder why you want as many friends as you could keep up with. I forget the exact quote, but, but as I develop those sorts of connections with people, that's the rule I always have, because I never want to be used. And I have been. I've been at a table where somebody was just seeking to get something, and then as I started chatting at a human level, they were automatically checked out and gone. And it was,
Isn't that interesting?
Painfully obvious. The only reason they were sitting in front of me was for something else. And so I never want to do that to anyone else, whether it's an organization or an individual.
Yes, it's an ugly thing to watch, and yet if I'm not careful, I can easily succumb to it. And I've caught myself doing that and realizing. So now I have to ask myself, what do I seek? And I'm always asking KJ these three questions, as if you have heard me speak much of late, I'm finding myself always addressing these three questions as a kind of a spiritual recalibration, a micro recalibration, because it only takes about 2 seconds to ask these
questions.
Sounds like
the title of a book.
Yeah, not bad. Yeah. But it's what do you seek? Who do you say I am? And do you love me more than these? And those are the three questions I find myself asking throughout the course of the day. I've done it several times already. Because if I'm with a person right now, what do I seek? Well, I seek that Jesus would be lifted up and honored. You know, what do you see? What you seek will define what you find. But rather than seek my own interests, I'm seeking the interests of others, because that's the whole point. Because if I'm seeking Jesus, then I'm going to seek the whatever begins with the love of God ends with the love of neighbor. So what do you seek is a defining question. Who do you say I am? The bigger that understanding. And then do you love me more than these? So that if I love people more than I love him, as you know, I'll love him them less than if I love Jesus more than them. But he will brook no rival. So I find that to be, like, I was just with a person, and this friend wanted me to introduce me to this guy, and he thought that this other fellow had something that I could use. And so, but I kept on just saying, we don't worry about that. And I just wanted to be present for him, not for what he could, any perceived benefit he could supply. But to do that, I have to ask myself, what am I seeking right now?
It's like the, you know, the Good Samaritan, you know, as all of those leaders are walking by someone on the road. And I know there, you know, this may be a stretch in applying, using the application of that parable, but I feel like sometimes when I'm with somebody and I know that there's a purpose for the meeting, if I'm not actually tending to the person themselves, I'm like one of those guys on the road walking by the injured person.
I hear you.
You never know if, you know, if for a time such as this, that maybe God has used those conditions to bring me in front of this person to hear their heart on something, or to be able to speak a word to them, or just to be an ear for them, you know? So, I'm not always good at, like you said, sometimes I, my type A characteristics get the best of me, and I gotta get things done, but, I'm trying really hard to be there with that person first, because, you know, I think in the long run, it is all about relationships.
Yep.
And I might get what I'm seeking, and it might be, you know, a mission success. But if I really tend to that person, I think that actually opens many, many more doors.
I think you're quite right. It's kind of the pathway of downward mobility actually leads to the greater good of all of us. And so, by serving that person first, I discover then that I can love him in Christ in a way that I otherwise would perhaps not be able to do. So it's an understanding. It's a hard thing, though, to dispel my agenda. And I have to look at, here's what I've tried to find. Let me run this by you. I'm seeking to distinguish between people as means and people as sources. So if I see them as a source, I will be committed to manipulating them. If I see them as a means God may or may not use, then I'm free to serve them and look to God for the outcome. And that's what I'm seeking to do in relationships. And I've never regretted doing that whenever I do it. I don't always succeed. But what about the needs of the others? It's the Philippians 2. You have to, the kenosis of letting Christ rule and reign. And so that is a kind of a death that takes place to make you fully alive to the grace of the present moment.
Yeah. Once again, there's a lot to chew on, but I agree with you. Because all of these incidental interactions are only temporal, and that, you know, they're going to come and go. But, you know, even there, when I lived there in Atlanta, for example, and you and I sat and chat over, I don't know how many cups of coffee at our favorite little French bakery.
I remember that very well. Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, we could have planned all sorts of events, but those events are come and gone. But I mean, here we are today, still friends and chatting and connecting in all sorts of ways. And that actually is the fruit of our the relationship we've developed. It's nothing unique to me. I've seen you do this with so many people over time. I mean, even before we hit record, just to see Will pop up in your background, and I shouldn't be surprised that you are fostering and cultivating these relationships still. And it's always nice to see a friendly face with you. So I see you doing this in practice all the time. But I think the eternal impact is going to be those relationships.
And I think that's in, at the end of the day.
Expect others, you know, you get what I'm saying.
No, it's absolutely so. When we think of stewardship, you know, and my book Leverage, I talk about the typical three, the time, talent, and treasure. But then we add the extra two, which is truth and relationships. I still can't find a good T to round out that alliteration. People have said team, things like that. It's forced. If you can find a T for people. But the whole idea, the parable of the unjust steward.
Yeah.
And then his application, I tell you, make friends for yourself by means of the wealth of unrighteousness so that when it fails, and that's when you die, there'll be people to receive you into the eternal dwelling. So his whole point is to leverage the first three, time, talent, and treasure, which are passing away, and to transmute it into the gold of that which is going to endure forever. And the two things that go for on in the two realms of stewardship that are now are God's truth and relationships. So by leveraging those things to build truth into people. But if I see people as means rather than that God may or may not use, but that he's the source, then I'm free to love Christ in them. And it's kind of a different way of seeing, but I never regret doing that when I do that. And then I don't have to be worried about my agenda.
Yeah. And let me ask you this. You've got me thinking here because I know, prior conversations, we're talking about, you know, the parable of the four soils, and you keep talking about the fourth soil. I'm always something that I've kind of camped out to think about a lot more deeply lately is conversion, true conversion. And you look at the other soils, and there seems to be a genuine response to the gospel in some of those soils because there is some life. And I wonder if these interactions you're talking about, the way we treat and encourage people, might actually not help, you know, at first you're helping those in the fourth soil flourish. I think implicitly doing what you're talking about in reaching the, you know, fourth soil people. But I wonder if you might not also be encouraging and helping those in some of the other soils that might actually still yet thrive because of the way you love and care for and relate to and treat with dignity. And, you know, the cares of the world might be working to choke out a potential faith. Then encounter someone who goes, yeah, I'm not just looking for something from you. I'm here to love you for who you are, regardless of what the outcome of this transaction is.
Thank you for tuning in to the Explorers Podcast. We'd like to remind you that Reflections Ministries is supported by the generosity of our friends like you. If you'd like to donate, please visit reflections.org today. Now back to the podcast.
The third soil, the worries of the world, the deceitfulness of riches and the desires for other things to enter in and choke the word and make it unfruitful. But at the same time, if I'm pitching my soil, my message to the fourth soil of people who receive and then multiply 30, 60, 100, it seems to me that I have seen third soil people moving, finally being drawn into because of something that so attracts them about the quality of the fourth soil people that they have come to know. That they have become fourth soilers. Now, I have a lot of these weekly studies, and there are a lot of third and some fourth soil people in there. But my desire is to create a context as well. Although I pitch my message to the fourth, I'm hoping that it'll become an attractor where it draws a third soil into the fourth realm. Even there, though, in the fourth realm, it's interesting, isn't it, that he says 30, 60, and 100 fold.
Yeah.
Interesting. He doesn't say 30, 60, and 90. Why does he jump from 30? It's not proportionate. And so, which means to me that he's not saying this exactly 30, 60, 100. But so you could even have a 25, 50, and 75, and 100x.
Sure.
But the point is that the hundreds, I think that the fourth soil is a small fraction of people.
Yeah.
Why does the gate? But still, I want to pitch my message there, but at the same time, believe that by the grace of God, people who aren't in that will somehow begin to move and become that kind of person. I want to treat people with dignity and possibility.
Agree. You might need a different term than soiler, though.
Yeah.
you know, no, that's interesting. And I remember, and this is probably over 15 years ago, before we really even got to know each other, but I listened to a lot of your work. You brought up, you know, the people in the fourth soil are a small number, and the way is narrow. And I wonder what your thoughts are these days with the state of the church. I feel like there is a lot. There you go. I think we have a perception that there are more true Christians, true followers of Christ, than there actually are.
And I think you're right.
You're the one who kind of sparked that thought in me. And I'm not trying to be judgmental. And I'm not walking around going, "He's a fake. He's a fake. She's a fake." But I've tried to be a little bit more spiritually in tune to this. And I wonder where your thinking has gone with this. What have you gone? Have you changed your mind, or have you gone? Have you seen your observations brought this out even more?
Even more, I'd say that many broad is the way that leads to destruction, and many there are that go in it. And so it's Jesus is the authority for the realization that the number of people who will choose the way of life is very small, relatively speaking. But if I think of the third soil, that's going to be, in my suspicion, the majority of and I think that they are true believers. It seems to me that there'd be the vast majority would be there. Of the four soil, am I right? I think it's less than 1%, the four soil. And then the fourth soil, if you have 100, then even within the four soil, Jesus invites us to see that there are degrees of fruitfulness, even in the four soil, which is fascinating to me. 30, 60, 100 fold. I might as well have it 25, 50, 75, 100x. But here's the beauty of that. The reward in the kingdom of heaven, as you well know, is not based upon how much time, talent, and treasure a person's been granted, but what they do with what they receive. So it's the divine equalizer. So that means that there's not a person who cannot, if they want to and aspire, in other words, long for more until they finally say that nothing else is sufficient. I wonder, because you look at the metrics of the kingdom of God and the 30, 60, 100 fold, these numbers, you can't quantify that because it has to do with the incalculably diffusive impact on the relationships that we have with others. But at the same time, there are degrees of productivity in the kingdom metrics, but it's totally unmeasurable by earthbound standards. So it's a very ambiguous thing because it means that many of the greatest people in the kingdom of God are going to be unknown and unmarked and unknown in the records of history.
Yeah, I think we're going to be surprised by some of the greatest.
A lot of surprises that are
wearing the most. Jewelry, if you will, in terms of rewards and things like that. They're going to be some of the most unknown people today.
Yeah, think about that woman who comes in on a retinue, remember in the Great Divorce? And she's an ordinary woman who's not even known, but she comes like a queen to invite her former husband to come the way of life. She diverts herself. And this woman who was a nun, unknown, but lived faithfully a hidden life and rested in unvisited tombs, as the end of Middlemarch puts it.
That's sobering as well. Just when you start to feel a little self-satisfied, you realize that's probably not the way to go.
No. That's not the way to do it, no.
No.
Your thoughts on discipleship, though, how are you now? Are there any changes in the way you're approaching this, or as you have this greater realization that it's you're looking for faithful people who would be willing to learn, and I call them fat and hot, faithful, available, and teachable, and hot is as honest, open, and transparent. You've probably, that's in conform to his image.
Fat and hot, that's, that definitely needs to be spoken in context.
You're absolutely right.
Honest, open, I remember fat, but I had forgotten hot.
Honest, open, and transparent. If you find a person is honest, open, and transparent, which is the hot, and then the fat being faithful, available, and teachable, hot and fat. It's a terrible image, but it's easy to remember.
Yeah, it is. It sounds like a song by Queen.
Song by Queen. That's great.
Yeah, what has changed? On one hand, I think practically. For your audience, the C.S. Lewis Institute is a discipleship ministry. We've been around since the 70s, and for the last 25 years, we've run the C.S. Lewis Fellows Program, which is a one-year-long discipleship program. We were founded by some men whose heart was not to make more fans of Lewis, make more people like Lewis. So we're about discipleship of heart and mind, just for context.
Yes, that's good.
And so So for 25 years, we've been running this a year one and a year two fellows program, which are just intentional and sometimes intensive, but it really isn't. It's just a very intentional discipleship program. And I did it years ago and it changed my life. And so in one sense, I haven't changed because the mechanics, if you will, remain the same. We still try to hit what I call every major point on the discipleship spectrum. You know, we put people in one-on-one mentoring relationships. We have them in discipleship groups of three or four people, which I like to call peer-to-peer discipleship at Greg
Peer-to-peer, yeah. Groups.
That's then we good. Have the, you know, your traditional small groups, and then we bring in someone like you or our friend Stuart or some other expert to speak on whatever topic we're studying. And so that's a one-on-many setting. Those haven't changed, but what has changed has been, I think, my own understanding of discipleship just grows more deep. Big thanks to you and helping me really think through, you know, the parable of the four soils in ways that I may have just glossed over it. You know, there's so many passages of scripture that you read so many times that sometimes you just skip over it so quickly because, like, I know this, and you don't stop to look at it with fresh eyes again. Which, you know, I'll make a little plug. Folks should pick up the book, The Surprising Genius of Jesus by Peter Williams, because he takes a look at the parables of Jesus with really fresh eyes. If you want to read the parables fresh again, get that. Mm-hmm. And then others like you helping me think a little bit more about how to help people be fat and hot. You know, because some people want to be honest and open and transparent, but they need some encouragement. They need a model. They need, you know, a setting, you know, and I like to describe in our case with the Fellows Program, I like to describe it as a laboratory for discipleship.
That's
where,
good.
You know, you can't compel the work of the Holy Spirit, but you can create conditions that are favorable for his work.
It's a greenhouse.
And cooperate with him.
Yeah, you're creating a discipleship greenhouse.
Yes, exactly right.
Yeah, because you can't pull out a plant out of the soil, but you can create the conditions for growth by the nurturing, the watering, the moisture, the temperature, all of those things. And to create a greenhouse, and that's our human responsibility, but then that creates the conditions where the Spirit of God then can use that in that synergistic unity and diversity for growth. I think it's you're creating greenhouses for growth.
Yeah, and I owe a lot to Greg Ogden for this, because he's actually used a similar metaphor. He called it the hothouse.
And that's what they call a greenhouse, and we call it a greenhouse. They call it a hothouse. Exactly. Yeah. So.
And so in that sense, that hasn't changed. But what I guess I'm growing and changing is, I guess perhaps I'm developing in my ability to watch people grow and see in some cases, you know, I've been doing this for 10 years now. You know, you start to see, not that you can create a formula, but you can see certain patterns. Certain people who maybe wrest with legalism, or certain people who wrestle with, you know, there's all sorts of things. We could try to identify certain, you know, spiritual pathologies. Yes. But then there's also just I think the biggest one that's really surprising me these days is the busyness of life, that the frenetic pace with which we live today. You
That's
know,
correct.
When I did the Fellows Program 15, 16 years ago, you know, we didn't have, you know, little computers in our pockets, you know.
No.
Yeah, there were smartphones, but they were they didn't even have internet on them yet. No. So now it is, you know, one hand, I want to tell folks, actually, you do have the time. You do have the time to carve out some time for you and God and to create a quiet space. But on the other hand, I also know that we just live with a really unhealthy pace of life. So I think the thing that's changed for me is to try to become a counteracting force for myself, but also for others to help them see that. And it's a constant battle.
Yes. I think that you're developing a wisdom that's a hard-earned wisdom. As you well know, we learn much more from our sorrows, setbacks, and sufferings than we do from our successes. But in that process, though, you gain a hard-earned wisdom where you begin to see gestalts, various patterns. You can see, I see this person has a pull toward this form of legalism or whatever it happens to be. You see a pattern. But then you're also seeking not to replace, rather to transform, but to actually, it's extinction, not extinction, but replacement with a better good. And so you are have a kind of a knowing a person and discerning what they're like and seeing yourself in that as well. You're able now to see, how can I serve this person in a more effective manner? So you see a pattern, you've done this before, and you begin to see there are certain tools at work, time-tested methods.
Yeah.
And one of those, if the people do not have Shabbat, they don't have Shalom. So how to teach them how to create mini Sabbaths, as well as the time of practicing his presence, which is, remember when I was there a couple of years ago, that was the theme, wasn't it? The life in the presence of God.
Just a year ago, just last year. It was about last year.
Really? Ah. It was, it does. I'd love to go up there again. We were talking about that, but it was life in the presence of God and a guide to practicing God's presence. And it was kind of radical stuff because yet it's mandated and yet people aren't doing it. So the very fact that I can practice his presence in the course of the day and find ways, but you have to make time. You can't find time. You have to you have to decide, what do you treasure? What the heart always makes room for what it treasures.
Yeah, well, you know, so this is a great time to bring in our friend Stuart. I remember something he said about, it had to be 12 or 13 years ago, maybe longer, but he had said this to a group of, you know, those who don't know Stuart. If you follow Ken, you probably do, but he's from Scotland. And he made this comment. He goes, "You Americans pursue excellence in everything you do, whether it's academics or sports or business. But when it comes to your spiritual lives, you're happy with a Sunday school level of education."
That's a good word.
And in my mind, that usually means it's probably a junior high level of Sunday school education, because most of us quit after the flannel graphs in junior high. And I know I'm generalizing there, but he's right. And at the same time, when I talk to people who struggle with carving out time for the word and prayer and to fend off the busyness, they miraculously somehow have time to train for a marathon or pursue an MBA on top of full-time work and a family. And these are huge undertakings, or go to, you know, they're CrossFit and they're up at 4:30 a.m. every day at the gym.
Yep.
You can make time for that. It's because they see those things as more measurable or maybe more tangible. And
I think that's right.
I just see that as a modern day manifestation of what Stuart said. But
yeah, you might call it a flannel graph theology. So that and they're satisfied with mediocrity in the spiritual, and that makes me it seems passing strange, which means they're not treasuring it. Again, we said that the heart treasures what it values. So then the question is, what do I seek? What do I want more than anything else? And if I don't ask that question, then if I can find room for these other things, and they're perfectly good things, but if the good becomes the enemy of the best, and then you have to decide, what am I going to give up in order to make this work? There's a sacrifice, there's a cost of discipleship, and it's training.
Yeah. Well, I got two things response, but the first one is there is a cost. And Mike Wilkins, who wrote The Masterful, Following the Master, which is a biblical theology of discipleship, he said the twin prerequisites for discipleship are cost and commitment. And he says that
cost
all throughout
commitment.
The New Testament, there's three primary audiences to whom Jesus is speaking. You know, you got his true disciples, you've got the ones who are out to get him, the religious antagonists, and then you've got this group of undecided. And he's primarily quite often speaking to this undecided group, calling them to count the cost and make the commitment. And I think we live in an age of casual commitment, and we live in an age where we want to keep all our options open. I call it the Netflix syndrome. You know, you ever sit in front of Netflix and you just scroll through the queue for an hour before you decide what to watch, because we want to watch everything. And or excuse me, I've encountered this when making plans with people, and I'm guilty of this too, is I don't want to commit to having dinner with you next Friday night because I may not feel like it. Mm-hmm. Instead of saying, yes, Ken, let's put it on the calendar. So that translates into our spiritual lives as well. And we are not willing to make a real commitment. We just kind of like to have our cake and eat it too.
I think that's correct. I love that idea of the Netflix syndrome, because it's the smorgasbord factor. There's a cafeteria of options. The more options there are, the less important each one becomes.
I'm glad you said smorgasbord. I used that word the other day, and people gave me a look. I'm like, you guys don't know what smorgasbord is?
Isn't that a weird thing? Yeah, it used to be very popular. It's somehow lost.
We're dating ourselves here.
We are indeed.
When you asked what I've changed. Yes. I do want to say I read this book by Eugene Peterson this last summer, part of this academic program I'm in, and it's a book called Working the Angles. And one of the things I really felt sort of convicted by, as he was talking about, you know, walking through life and sitting down with folks, and we have this tendency to try to fix their problems. And I think because I've done some theological training now and I've got some experience in discipleship, and I may have seen some of these gestalts that you're talking about, it's very quick to jump to a conclusion and go, oh, Ken, I know what you need to do. You need to blah, 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 blah. And his thing was, ask yourself, how are you going to help this person in this situation? Rather than just immediately give answers and try to fix their problems, help them see the love of Christ in this moment. Maybe help them see what Christ is trying to say to them. And that's a much more difficult proposition. And I remember after reading it, I sat down with a young man who works in inner city ministry here in Chicago. And I've been mentoring him for a bit. And as he was relaying some things to me, I immediately started going into fix it mode or suggesting things. And I never tell people what to do. I've got a little more savvy than that, but I'll suggest some things like, oh, you might consider, but I caught myself because that's still what I'm trying to do. And I thought, this is really, really hard. So I would say that's another thing that I've probably changed and grown in, is trying to, like, how do I help them see Christ in the midst of this? Because this trial may not go away. God may be bringing them. So how do I help them stay rooted and grounded in love and keep their eyes on Christ?
That's a good word, isn't it? Because you're really seeking not to solve a problem or cure a thing when it's not your power to do, but rather to give them a perspective on their pain in the midst of the adversity, and then to weep with those who weep and rejoice with those who rejoice, so that you're taking, helping them. You're going into the world in a sort of way, and to be a comfort, an agent, and a person who says, this is a perspective that we need to embrace and cling to in the midst of the pains of life. And I'm there with you. And so that empathy, that instead of trying to solve a problem, my wife has Parkinson's disease. When people hear that, they immediately want to tell me what she needs to do to get fixed.
Well, I've noticed that tendency is when you're having dinner or lunch or coffee with someone and they have an issue, other people that were with immediately start peppering them with all sorts of questions. And I know the inclination is to be helpful.
Yes, they mean well.
You know, I think I've stopped doing that a while ago because it's happened to me enough. I'm like, the 30 questions you're going to ask me, I've already gone down all of these roads.
You've gotten down that way.
Yeah, now but I feel like I'm just being litigated against. Like, well, you probably haven't taken enough magnesium.
Yeah, precisely so. So they're offering the solution instead of being their presence and their love and their grace, and to love a person but to be with them in their pain, but at the same time realize that the best is yet to come, and that God redeems what He allows, and that's a word of comfort and hope. That transcends whether the thing changes or not is not the issue. That all shall be well, and all manner of things shall be well, and that's the perspective we want to give to people, because that's the hope that empowers this. But this whole idea of cost and commitment, I'm going to chew on that more as being components that really are essentials of discipleship. The cost of discipleship and the commitment.
Well, and I look at that. Let me amplify that a tad. I look at that as, so these are sort of the starting conditions to a a fruitful, flourishing, discipling effort. But they don't have to be, you know, if you think about them being on a rheostat, like a dimmer switch,
yes.
You don't always have to have an intense amount of commitment. It doesn't have to be. So I'll describe our fellows program sometimes to you know, help people say, go think of it as spiritual CrossFit. You know, we're getting a spiritual workout in a sense, but not everything has to be CrossFit. You know, there's power walking, there's jogging, there's light calisthenics. And so, you know, in a day to day, you know, I tell folks with our program, this is a very intentional 1 year program. We're not pretending that this is what discipleship looks like day in and day out for people. We're in a unique, like I said, it's a laboratory. We get you for a year and we're trying to do some detoxing from casual Christianity and other things. And, you know, it's almost like a boot camp in some ways. But, you know, I don't want people to fear this idea of commitment. I mean, it can be something as simple as, you know, if I'm a young man and I came to you and said, Ken, I really admire you. I would really love if you would just mentor me, you know, into the faith. And you say, great idea, KJ, let's meet Thursdays at that French bakery. And let's just meet there at 6 a.m. And we're just going to go through the Gospels over the course of the next year.
Mm-hmm.
I go, great. Well, there's a commitment right there. We're both going to meet on Thursdays at the right time. And the assumption is I'll come prepared to discuss whatever we agreed to read. And if I only show up every third Thursday, you have every right to go, KJ, I keep showing up. 6 a.m. is early. I've got other things to do. It can be low levels of commitment, but there just needs to be some sort of grounds to go, yeah, this is the path we're going to go on. And they don't have to be forever. It could be like, you could say, KJ, let's meet for the next 4 months and see how it goes.
But they have to have some skin in the game. And so they have to, that even if it's not a great deal, there's a certain minimal requirement of the cost of discipleship, and where it's going to invade something else, and that so that everything you take on is another thing you cannot do. So you have to just decide, what do I seek, what do I want? Yes. More than anything else.
No, absolutely. And and I think what you're describing there too, to go back a couple, where you're talking about, you know, when we're listening to people and trying to offer all these solutions, I think another thing I've observed a little bit more is what terrible listeners we have become in today's society. Mm. And that has to do with a lot of the busyness. And I think if we were able to and this kind of goes back to our earlier discussion of when we're sitting down and relating to people and treating them, you know, as ends instead of means, and you use the other, you know, comparison of sources. But if we're really being with that person, you know, it is going to mean dropping a lot of the preconceived answers and responses that we're ready to usually give, and to really truly listen and be with someone. And that can be intimidating, because you don't know maybe what the other person's going to say, and you won't know how to respond. And I've observed this in myself, and I've observed this in others. And I'm trying to craft a way, you know, like art of listening or something, of really hearing someone and truly responding to what they say and not to what you know. I mean, if you just jump this over into something like apologetics, how many times have you heard somebody ask a question and the answer is pretty much unrelated to what that person's asking? Or it's not hearing the question that's behind the question, right? You know, oh, this person is, why would God let my father die? And you know, actually, there's a lot of pain or something. And that's a simplistic one. But so this listening and being with someone, it really is an art that we haven't cultivated, because we're usually moving on to the next thing.
That's exactly so. I used to teach a course for IBM managers called the Effective Listening. It was a workshop that they had when they had outside consultants. This is years ago. And I'm inclined to want to go back to some of those principles, because we get training in our education. We learn how to write. We learn how to, in some cases, speak. We learn how to study and think. But we never learn how to listen. We don't have courses on that. And so people pick up these naturally bad habits by stepping other people's ideas and playing intellectual chess, or all those things, and not hearing. I think that effective listening is very rare, but it's a key to effective communication, which is the key to effective relationships. But when people don't listen well, I think it requires other-centeredness, so that the more grace we give to other people, the more we'll listen to them and stop imposing our agenda and hearing what's the question behind the question. And listen, and I think, as you well know, we've talked about this, even with dialogical apologetics, the whole idea of asking a person a question and then listening carefully and then asking another question based on that and helping them to uncover and discover. So that's a huge need, and it's more now than ever before. We've been given two ears and one mouth. We should use them more proportionately.
Exactly. You know, and one thing that we aren't taught that. One thing I'm finding helpful, and I do this, and I use it in the context of our apologetics training, because that is one where we're trying to, you know, we kind of take a conversational apologetics approach, because, you know, there are a lot of great apologists out there, you, William Lane Craig, others that are addressing certain answers and problems that we don't need to readdress. But one thing I think people are struggling with is this sort of thing. And so listening is one of those things I try to cultivate. And believe it or not, the world of improv theater has some great exercises that you can play with that are some, 'cause in an ensemble of improv theater, the ensemble has to be able to respond and be attuned with one another, you know, because you don't know what's going to happen because it's improv. And so they do these exercises and warm-ups. And there's like one that's called like, listen to the end of the sentence. And it's a game where I speak, I'll say a sentence, and your response to it, your first word has to be the last word in my sentence, which means you have to listen to the end of the sentence.
That's a good technique.
And then in your response, whether we're doing this in a circle or it's just you and me, I have to do the same thing. And so we both have, and you can't sit there and pre-plan what you're going to say, because I don't know what your last word is going to be. And so we do a little bit of this, and folks are like, wow, that was harder. Or I'll do another one where I don't remember the name of this game, but it is something along the lines of where we ask questions. And all I can do for 2 minutes is just ask you questions. And what this combats is, so, you know, if you and I are meeting for the first time and we start chit-chatting and you tell me that you know Stuart McAllister, me too. And then immediately I can, and this can be unintentional, but I hijack the conversation where we were talking about you. I make it about me and I go on for 5 minutes.
That's right.
And, you know, but what I'm really trying to do is I am trying to establish a connection with you. But what we need to do is practice some patience sometimes. And I listen, you talk, and then go, you know, that's fascinating. Did you know I know Stuart McAllister too? What? But what we always do is nowadays people have no patience and we interject and we end up hijacking conversation. So to make someone sit there for 3 minutes, 2 or 3 minutes, and just ask the other person questions, and every follow-up has to be another question. So there are ways to make people listen. And I think we need to practice them more.
I think otherwise, the only people who listen to us are people who are therapists, people we pay.
Oh, we pay them. Yes.
Yeah. Otherwise, they're not going to listen. And this is a sad thought, where it becomes a platform for their own ideas rather than a receptivity of an engagement. And that's why I like what we've been doing. We've been doing a dialogue, but it's not in trying to overwhelm the conversation or the idea or hijack it.
Right, right. And I it's rare that you can do this. And I have sort of this internal mantra that I've always told myself for a while. It's never pass up an opportunity to keep your mouth shut.
That's a good word.
Yeah. And I remind myself, because there's so many times that I want to say something. But, you know, so you were talking about listening. One of my favorite quotes is from Francis Schaeffer. And he said that if I only have 1 hour with someone, I'll spend the first 55 minutes asking questions and finding out what is troubling their heart and mind. And then in the last 5 minutes, I will share something of the truth. And that's sort of another one of those rules that I kind of use for myself, is if I want to say something that's worthwhile, it's going to take some investigation and digging in for me to figure out what to truly say. And that's what it makes relating a lot easier.
It does indeed. It's other-centered. And so to put the needs of the other person and to listen and get involved with them is going to be a richer conversation than if I tried to hijack it and tell them what I know. but rather it's about them. So it is requires the grace of other centeredness to be an effective listener. And Jesus the wisdom of Proverbs is wonderful. There are so many wise things. How many times have I regretted? There are so many things I've regretted saying, but I rarely regret not saying something. And when my view is, when in doubt, don't.
That's a very, very good
one. When in doubt, don't. Yeah. Whether it's humor or whether it's just throwing in something that might be inappropriate, I'd rather not say it. I don't regret things I haven't said, but when I say it, it's out of the toothpaste, it's out of the tube.
Yeah, that's good. That's good.
Well, this has been a great time with you, my friend. I've enjoyed it. We'll do it another time because you bring out things in me that others don't.
You know, that's something Lewis had made a comment about when one of their friends had died. And they mentioned that not only did they lose their friend, but he lost a part of himself because that friend only brought out certain aspects. That's a good observation.
Yes, yes. It was the Festschrift on Williams because...
Yeah, Charles Williams. That's right.
Yeah, because Charles Williams, and there's a thing that died in them. That he only uniquely brought out.
Yes.
So there's a layering, I think, of a loss in relationships in some respects, but a relayering in heaven. But I want us to pick up on this in our next time, in some time, future time, but I want to go up to Chicago with you and be up there as well. So let's make that happen as well.
I love that. Okay.
I'd love to be up there with you and your people. And I implored what you're doing with Conform to His Image and what you're doing with the C.S. Lewis Institute.
Yeah, you want me to say a little bit about that, Ken?
So yeah, folks, if you don't mind, yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. One of the things that I'm impressed, I've had Conform to His Image on my shelf for, you know, almost two decades now. And I remember when I first bought it, the first time I'd ever seen you speak was in Washington, D.C. At a C.S. Lewis Institute event. And I ran up and got your book, and somebody was there and said, you gotta read this like you would drink molasses very slowly. And I did. And I loved it. And I'm glad to have, the new version of it yes. Here, a little product placement. But I'm convinced that it is underutilized and underappreciated in general. And so here in Chicago, you know, the C.S. Lewis Institute, we're all about discipleship. We don't care if you're using, you know, our resources or someone else's. We just want to see people cultivate the heart and mind of Christ and flourish in their faith. And so I've got a dear friend who's on my board, and he's pursuing theological training himself. And he's been leading groups. We did a test one last year of an online Conform to His Image group, and they loved it. And so I think more people should be using this. And you know, you could use it for individual study, but I think it's more fun with a group of people to walk.
I think so.
Like you said, other people are going to bring things out. And, I did pitch to Ken that, you know, you should kind of create a process of certifying small group leaders. So regardless of the direction that goes, I just want to encourage people to actually deliberately take this book and sit down with folks and walk through it. And I mean, you've been super helpful. When we've had questions, you know, we can reach out and ask you. So you and your ministry are great. So if folks ever run into a wall and they don't understand something, all they do is ask. But all your resources back this up. I think everybody should use this book.
Well, I will pay you later.
That was completely improvised.
I know that. No, that's wonderful. And I like the idea of some kind of a certification program, and I like the fact that you're testing it out and working with people in that way in the field. And we want to make it more accessible and make it more of a kind of a curriculum that will make it more accessible. So I'll be keeping you in the loop with that.
Yeah, because it'd be nice to have a group of people that have been through the course and know a bit more of what they're doing. You don't want the blind leading the blind necessarily.
That's right.
It'd be nice to have someone who's got, you know, can see through a glass darkly a little bit.
That's right. KJ, it's been lovely to have you with me. And this has been Explorers, and I'm grateful for your presence with us.
Thanks, God bless. Man. It's been fun.
Thank you for being a part of the Explorers podcast. Please like and subscribe, and we'll see you next time.